William Patrick III has 48 years of experience in biowarfare. He served 21 years in the former U.S. offensive program at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and then 15 years in defense studies at the U.S. Army Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick as chief of the Plans and Program Office. The title of his presentation is Bioterrorism: The Impact of Particle Size on Aerosol Infectivity.
I want to thank this fine organization for having me out, and in particular, I want to thank Dr. Janet Orient for inviting me out to talk a little bit about biological warfare and its derivative, bioterrorism. Now, I'm not here today to talk about the morality of this stuff. That's up to you folks. But I'm here to tell you that biological warfare has not gone away. Certainly, bioterrorism has not gone away. And in November 25th, 1969, I want you to remember that date, 25 November 1969, if you get nothing more out of my talk than that, President Nixon came to Fort Detrick, Maryland, and disestablished the Biological Warfare Program. And we all lost our jobs. 1,800 of us lost our jobs. But biological warfare has not gone away. The fact that when the Soviet Union finally admitted that they had a BW program, to give you some feel of the magnitude of that program, they produced or had the potential of producing 4,500 metric tons of dried anthrax per year. I mean, that is a figure that's inconceivable to me. So if we look at our own BW program, is a pointer there? Oh, got another. Okay, thank you. We could produce almost a metric ton of dried anthrax, almost a metric ton. But it's a good thing we didn't get in a shooting war with the Soviet Union if we're relying on biological warfare, because we would have lost hand down. Now, biological warfare and its derivative bioterrorism is something that's very hard to detect. The fact that the Soviet Union had this huge program where they produced not only large quantities of anthrax, but tularemia and other organisms, Ebola, for example, Ebola virus. Our intelligence agencies knew absolutely nothing about this huge program. We didn't know anything about the Iraqis were doing until we sent people over to that country in 1992, 1993, and we actually found out that they had a real active program. And I guess they got out of the business after about 1994, and I don't know why, but they did. So biological warfare and bioterrorism is something that you relatively hide easily, and it's something that doesn't lend itself very effectively for our intelligence agencies to pick up. This is determined whether you're sleeping. All right, that's my effort to be funny. I won't charge with this anymore. Okay, but I am going to talk to you about a little experiment that we did, not a little experiment, a massive experiment we did in 1950-1951 time frame. And it concerned the attack on San Francisco using a simulant organism that closely resembled Bacillus anthracis, the causative agent of anthrax. We use the organism Bacillus globigii, a spore-forming organism. Now, we wanted to know whether a city such as San Francisco or any other seaport was vulnerable to a BW attack that occurred not on the land, but at sea. So we sprayed in 1950 a line of Bacillus globigii spores 2 miles long, 2 miles off the coast of San Francisco, with a material that I believe would be something that the today's terrorists could produce without any problems. What I'm trying to say is that this material was not sophisticated. It was not a very good product, nor was it disseminated with a very efficient munition. But anyway, we did this attack at sundown and allowed the wind to take the aerosol in and across San Francisco. Now, before talking in detail about the results, I'd like to show you the impinger sampler that we used to collect the aerosol. It's an all-glass impinger. And the main features of this sampler is that we put out thousands of these things in downtown San Francisco and its surrounding area, depending on where the Met people said the aerosol would be going. So the beauty of this system is that it is operated by means of a vacuum pump located here to pull the sample in, and it's battery operated so that you don't have to rely on electric lines to confuse the issue. But the aerosol comes in and is impinged in the liquid, and you assay the concentration of the liquid. Now, we're not interested in big particles. You've all heard that 1 to 5 micron particle size is the one that we want for biological warfare, bioterrorism. So we put a British pre-impinger on this device, and it picks out and eliminates particles that are larger than about 6.5 microns. Big particles are caught and trapped by this British pre-impinger. So the aerosol that comes into this system here is composed of 1 to 5 microns. Now, this orifice here is very critical to the operation of this device. The orifice is made such that the sampler is pulling about 12.5 liters of air per minute. We believe that's about the rate that you're breathing if you're walking around downtown San Francisco. So by knowing where the impinger sampler was and the length of time that it's being operated and the fact that you assay this material and you know the concentration, it's all small particle materials, you can get a pretty good estimate. I won't say completely accurate, but a pretty good estimate of what that aerosol is like and where it goes. So, at sundown, spraying or disseminating 130 gallons of a not very good grade of anthrax slurry, our impinger samplers showed that we infected an area of downtown San Francisco about in this area here. Now, this particular trial was done at sundown under very good Met conditions, deliberately so. We have a nice 10-mile-an-hour wind, a very heavy inversion that keeps the aerosol on the ground where you are. And we believe, based on the results of the impinger samplers, that we would have infected about 400,000 people. Now, that's a term that I find hard to believe, but this is an actual field test using an organism that very closely resembled anthrax. And Dr. Hausman has already told you the problems facing one, our medical community and our defense community, of dealing with that large number of people. So, and the reason why I say that is we have more than 1,000 spores per liter per minute. More than 1,000 spores per meter here, here, and here, over in Berkeley. In the area circumscribed by this color here, I don't know what that is, I guess it's green, you probably would have gotten infected because the impinger samplers were showing between 100 and 1,000 spores per liter per minute. If you'd been in this area here by Oakland, where we are now, you probably would not have gotten infected because the count was simply too low. You would not have breathed in enough of this material to cause an infection. So based on this result, I think you'll agree with me that that attack, a scenario that's not, it's a field test that you haven't generated with imagination and a pencil, that's a very effective attack. And this moderate grade of material disseminated, let me get this right now, disseminated 3 × 10^15 spores. That's a large number of spores, isn't it? That's 3,000 times a trillion. We also showed through the impinger samplers that in the area here, about 6 miles downwind in the central part of the city, we're putting up 50 million infectious doses of anthrax. Wow, 50 million. At this point over here in Berkeley, we're putting up about 500 infectious doses. So we're talking about large numbers, gang. Now, if we'd waited just 3 years, we learned a lot in the 3 years that we would put up a much more dense cloud, because we then learned in this interim period that that viscosity, solids content, surface tension, all these things, the physical properties that slurry had to do a lot to how efficiently it disseminated. So if we waited just 3 years, we probably would have put down 5 × 10^18 spores. Now that's 5 million times a trillion. We're talking about serious amounts of organism now, aren't we? Now, on another day, we disseminated 130 gallons of BG slurry, and the mint conditions were not appropriate. The winds were gusting 35, 45 miles an hour. Not a good day for a biological warfare attack. But we did the experiment anyway, just to show what mint conditions would do on the target, and we could not get a consistent pattern of organism. So this essentially is a attack that was not successful. You couldn't get any degree of consistency in any of the impinged samplers. Wind tore the integrity of the aerosol, and it was dissipated. On another day, now remember, this is back in 1951, 50-51 time frame, we sprayed 130 gallons of Serratia marcescens, a gram-negative vegetative cell. We would not do that today. All of you know that on occasion, gram-negative organisms are very, very nasty organisms and can cause a very nasty type of infection. But anyway, we'd gotten this strain of Serratia marcescens, or SM, from the British, and they assured us that it had never caused an infection in people. So we sprayed this material, 130 gallons, under very good mint conditions. We had a moderate inversion that keeps the aerosol on the ground, a nice 12-mile-an-hour wind. That's nice and gentle, delivers that aerosol without breaking up the integrity. And ladies and gentlemen, we found only a few organisms in about the 25-foot area, interior area of the Wharf area of San Francisco, and no place else. Wow. We were expecting that this organism would do just about the same thing as the anthrax had done, anthrax simulant. But in retrospective analysis, we concluded that there is sufficient ultraviolet light present at sundown to kill a vegetative cell. I'll say it again. There is sufficient ultraviolet light present in the sundown to kill a vegetative cell. And this has a tremendous impact on the type of organisms that you use on an open-air target. Look, for example, Brucella, tularemia, virus of Venezuelan aquinocephalitis virus. All these things can't be used in an open-air target provided sunlight is present, even at sundown. And we showed this trend again and again when we went out in the Pacific and actually field-tested agents, and also field-tested agents in the cold climates of Alaska. So this was a very, very important test and defined for us the direction by which the program would go. Now, there are two organisms that are resistant to sunlight, anthrax spore and the spore-like organism, Coxiella burnetii, that causes the disease Q fever. So, but vegetative cells, by and large, can't be used on an open-air target. And based on that information, we believe that an intelligent terrorist would not attack Mother Nature, would not confront Mother Nature, because she puts up all sorts of things. Presence of ultraviolet light, the presence or absence of an inversion, temperature-humidity conditions we haven't discussed, and we won't today because we don't have time. But anyway, intelligent terrorist, I think, would attack an enclosed environment where you don't have to worry about wind speed, ultraviolet light, and what have you. And most of our buildings are very, very sensitive and very susceptible to a BW attack because we humidify, make it very nice for us. We also make it nice for the organism. We have the right temperature and what have you. So since I'm out in San Francisco, I thought it would be very nice to tell you folks about the San Francisco trial of early days of the BW program. Now, I'm going to change gears, and I'd like to have the next, CD-ROM. Where are we? Jeremiah, where are we when I need you? Are there any questions on this while we're waiting to have the... All right. Well, waiting on the... If you don't mind, change the... we'll change directions here. But while we're doing this, when I first came to Dietrich, I had to take a lecture on the use of the gas mask. And I was sitting by in a very small room crowded people. And I happened to be sitting by an old bioweaponer who had been in the program since 1953. I joined the program in 1951. And as the lecturer was giving me all the details of the use of the gas mask, Lou Dixon kept punching me in the side, and I got frustrated. I said, "Lou, for Lord's sake, shut up. Let me listen to this lecture. It might save my life one day." And he says, "What a bunch of crap. What a bunch of stuff." And he said, "I'm going to show you the realistic things about biological warfare," and he did. So that very afternoon, we went out to the grid area, and he had me do this. I walked down about 100 meters from where he's standing, and I turn and face him in the wind, and he sprays a small amount of that anthrax simulant, Bacillus clubegii. I don't know when the aerosol comes. I don't know when it leaves. And he assays my face. I have huge numbers of spores when the assays become available. There are no spores around my waist and legs. He wants to point out to me that the primary aerosol, the one that we have to worry about, the one that's going to affect you, behaves as a gas. It goes around things. The next day, or whenever the met conditions were appropriate, we repeated that experiment. Again, I walked down 100 meters from where he's standing, and he sprays a very minute quantity of liquid, and I keep my back to it, to the wind, and he has me do this. Now, in 1951, everyone wore tie to work. Men, women, children, we all wore ties. Now, again, I don't know when the aerosol comes. I don't realize when it passes me because it is completely immune to my senses. But he assays my face, my clothing. There's one spore that I've not covered with my tie. There are no spores on my body here. There are no spores on my back. The aerosol goes around you because it behaves as a gas, and the gas goes around you. Now, just turning your back to the wind reduces the probability of infection, doesn't it? And we all wear clothes. If you know when that aerosol is coming, you can do something. You can put whatever clothing you have over your face, and you reduce significantly the probability of infection. That sounds pretty good. Now, the problem here, gang, is that you don't know when that primary aerosol is coming. You don't know when it's coming. And to date, we don't have a bell that rings and says, "Okay, we got a primary aerosol on the way. Let's take some sort of remedial action. Let's put on a gas mask, put something over our head, go to a room that we keep under positive pressure. Or let's go to a room that you use duct tape and plastic to reduce the amount of atmospheric air coming into the room, like the Israelis did during the 1967 war, and more recently when the Iraqis were sending over Scud missiles. Now, the hooker here is that, again, we don't know when that aerosol is coming. Now, that's been a problem facing biological warfare since 1943. and perhaps, just perhaps, the physicists working at the national laboratories are not designing as many atomic or hydrogen bombs as used to, and they're now taking up the problem of a rapid and reliable identification of that primary aerosol. Now, until we do that, we're always behind in the power curve. Now, this is not to say that we shouldn't have programs that increase the precision of our diagnostic procedures. We also have a large amount of study going on that direction, and we've made a lot of improvement in diagnostic of these things. We've spent a lot of money on biological warfare since the anthrax letters of 2001. But I don't think we are much more prepared than when we were 5 or 6 years ago. Let me give you an example. The post office has spent about $1 billion on a sniffer that sniffs the mail. And with anthrax, only anthrax, they can identify that organism in about 3 to 4 hours. That's pretty good. But gang, if I'm a terrorist, all I've got to do is change organisms. So we've spent $1 billion developing the system, and we're going to spend another $500 million in putting all these devices into various post offices across the country. And what we've done is that we've created an old the Maginot Line in night following World War I, the French, you know. Hugely area of defense, and yet the Germans bypassed it in World War II, and it was absolutely worthless. And that's the way I feel about this thing that the post office has developed. And we've spent a lot of money, but all you got to do is change organisms, and you bypass that lovely system. Okay. Let's talk about aerosol particle size and infectivity. That's what I wanted to talk to you about today, and have squandered a lot of my time, but I thought it'd be interesting to go over the scenario with San Francisco. All of you travel by here, and you know the problems we face in traveling. Okay. Today we're going to talk about two variables that are important to infectivity, the type of infection that's caused by a primary aerosol, and that is the integration of particle size and agent concentration. Now, much of the data that we're going to talk about today came about as a result of Dr. William C. Day, who was chief of experimental biology at the old Biological Warfare Laboratories at Fort Detrick. And he made a survey. Well, before we get to that, I, as chief of product development division, I was privileged to manage about 80 scientists, physicians, veterinarians, engineers, and technicians whose mission in life was to create the best possible products for infecting people. Probably the most offensive division at Fort Detrick during our offensive days. But Bill would ask me and my group to prepare all sorts of unique products, and we were able to do that. And it was a privilege of working with him because he made a lot of the substantial improvements in what we know about aerosols and infectivity. Now, before he got involved in this, he made an extensive survey of ambient air in different locations. And he found that the particle size in ambient air is about 12 and 13 microns, mass medium diameter. That's about the particle size he would find in this room here right now. We're coughing, we're occasionally sneezing, we're talking. Particle size about 12, 13 microns. Now, from the standpoint of biological warfare, that's too big. You're not going to involve many infections with that sort of particle size. And that 12, 13 microns was in ambient air showed up in almost all the types of buildings and potential areas that he looked at. He looked at office buildings, hospital wards, even operating rooms, dental offices, and even sewage disposal plants. And he still got that 12, 13 microns. And this is not a survey that was limited to him. Many other surveys have been established since that time, and they all show a 12 to 13 micron particle. And that's simply too big for biological warfare. Now, since particle size is given to you as a distribution of particles, the particle size might be 13 microns, mass medium diameter, but there are going to be particles less than that, and there are going to be particles bigger than that. So he also looked at the particles smaller than 12 microns, even particles in the range of 1 to 2, 3 microns. And what he found was that these particles, these small particles, either didn't contain an organism or the organism was dead. Well, now this doesn't speak very highly for biological warfare, because the secret of biological warfare is to get small particulates inhabited with an infectious agent. That's the whole secret of biological warfare. And he conferred, and I agree with him, that Mother Nature does not usually create small particle, highly infectious aerosols. And if she did, we probably would not have survived as a species. It is the artificial manipulation of putting infectious particles into these small aerosol particulates, 1, 2, 3, 4 micron particle, that is the real cause of biological warfare and bioterrorism. Now, the problems in the laboratory and in the pilot plant and also in the production facility, we got infections where we had high levels of energy being applied to the liquid agent. Blending operations, Waring blender in the laboratory, emulsifying engine like the Eppenbach mill in pilot plant and production studies. A lot of energy, a lot of infections. Centrifugation, a lot of energy, a lot of infections. And then, of course, when we developed powders, free-flowing, highly concentrated, composed of small particles, when we started manipulating these powders, it was a whole new ball game. The safety procedures and protocols that we worked out for liquid agents did not work for these dry powders. Didn't work at all. Our infection rate went way up, and it took about 9 months of changes to our way we did business to bring our infection rate down to where it had been when we were using liquid agents. So, dried agents constitute an entirely different problem for people who are trying to defend against this sort of thing. I will say one thing about the anthrax letters, and we'll shut up about that. The material in the anthrax letter was composed of small particles. It's highly concentrated, but it was also highly charged. Highly charged. Now, you can't use a highly charged particle when you have an offensive program. You're trying to recover the maximum amount of material from the dryer. You're trying to fill munitions because this stuff is flying everywhere. I never will forget the day in 1958 we'd learned how to produce these dried powders without milling, small particles without milling. We opened the freeze dryer in the hood, and all the material came barreling out, landed on the gloves, on the inside of the glass of the hood, and we should have recovered 7 grams of agent. We recovered 5/10 gram of agent. Everything else was flying around in the hood. So one of the first things we had to do was to reduce that or eliminate the charge of these small particle powders. And it's not unique to anthrax. It's tularemia, VEE, brucella. Any of these particles, when you have powders in the 1 to 2, 3 micron range, become electrostatically charged. And you've got to get rid of that material if you're going to consider it a BW agent. But from the standpoint of the anthrax letters, I think the charge would actually aid in the dissemination. You know, opening up a letter does not constitute much of a level of energy, does it? But if it's charged and you open up the letter, it goes flying around. And therefore, the material in the letters, good, small particle material, not weapons grade. Had to break the charge for it to be weapons grade. Okay. Particle size, microns, mass, medium, diameter. I'll remind you that, and you already know this, that 1.5 micron particle contains 53 1-micron particles. 1.5 micron particle is the equivalent in volume of 53 1-micron particles. And if you're developing a BW agent, as I was, you try to get all your material in 1-micron particle where you have the potential of infecting 53 people as opposed to one person over here with all the material in that one particle. And size does matter. Now, if you get 53 1-micron particles in a 5-micron particle, you can only get, I think, 16-micron particles of a larger size. Now, particle size was a universal phenomenon. Every organism we ever studied, there was this relationship. As particle size increased, so did the number of organisms required for the infection increases. And we used guinea pig as a case in point. And we look at all the some of the agents that we work with, and we find that, yeah, as particle size increases, so does the number of organisms. Now, how's my time? When do I stop?
You have about 28 minutes.
28 minutes. Okay, thank you. When we started doing aerosol work at Dietrich, we would explode a material from an old explosive bomb that we inherited from the British, and we couldn't repeat the work day to day to day. And the reason why we couldn't repeat it is because these bombs were producing aerosols of heterogeneous makeup. And we didn't make any sense out of this sort of thing until we developed three disseminators that produced homogeneous particles with a sharp cutoff point. For example, the Veper nebulizer. If this represents the particle size of the aerosol, then you disseminate, and you find that if you disseminate with the Veper nebulizer, you find most of the particles that you've disseminated are in the 1 to 2 micron particle, and 2 to 5 microns. You have 516 here. And you see, the big particles from the they don't exist when you use the Veper nebulizer. Now, you go to a different type of atomizer, the Collison, and you find that you've shifted that aerosol to the right. And when you use a spinning disk, depending on the reed that you use for dissemination, you've really now pushed the cloud over to the right so that you can study the impact of particles that are much larger. So with this sort of information, whereby we were able to produce a homogeneous population of particles with a sharp cutoff point, then the first time we could start making some progress into what particle size really meant. And here's a case in point. We're going to disseminate tularemia in a static aerosol chamber, and the particle size of that aerosol is roughly 1 micron. And these are the percentage of aerosol particulates here, and we find that it only takes 14 tularemia cells, Q5 strain, to cause an infection in the guinea pig. That's an LD50. Now, can you see? I guess these things are too small to see from the rear, are they not? Oh, you can still see it? I'm a good driver. I just don't see too well. Okay, now, forget about this 1-micron particle. Let's generate a particle of 6.5 microns. And you see we've shifted that curve. Most of the particles now fall within 5 to 7, 8, 10 microns. It now requires 178 tularemia particles to cause infection in the rhesus monkey. And Let's forget about the 6.5 micron aerosol. Let's create another aerosol of 11.5 microns. And you see the number of organisms required to kill the monkey, LD50. It now requires 672 cells. And if you can create an aerosol and study it long enough, those particles are dropping out very quickly. It now takes 3,447 cells of tularemia to kill that to kill the monkey. So that's the sort of relationship we found with all the organisms. The bigger the particle, the more particles that you need, more organism you need to infect. Now, if you look at particle stability on this axis here, we're talking about particle size in terms of mass or volume, medium, diameter. And we're looking at biological decay rate. We find that we have a situation that we don't want in biological warfare. Big particles decay very, very slowly in aerosol. Small particles that we want decay very rapidly. So in that respect, everything that you do is just bass aquids. If we look at the number of cells to require the aerosol infection, this axis, and we're looking at small versus big, again, it's just the opposite of what we want. So we have to manipulate this thing during our weaponization program. Now, what we did is Bill Day took Serratia marcescens, which was at that time one of the smallest organisms in the area, taxonomic situation. And he created an 1/10 micron particle, and he finds very few living organisms in that 1/10 micron. And if you look at viability of cells that are in that small particle, it's very, very low. It's what he found in the general survey of as previously reported. And as particle size increases, so does viability. But again, we don't want these big particles. Now, this is a classic experiment done at Dietrich in whereby we compared humans, to guinea pigs, to monkey responses. Now, where do we get the people from this experiment? This has been in the 1950s, late 50s and early 1960s. We had two countries that were against us, Red China and Soviet Union. And we had a draft. And these young people from the Seventh-day Adventist Church wanted to serve their country, and they did not want to train with rifles. So they volunteered to come into the Army for the specific purpose of coming to Fort Detrick to being used as guinea pigs. And we used these young people, about 1,000 of them, to determine for the first time the number of infectious doses required for tularemia, the number of infectious doses required for Coxsackie burnae, and the number of infectious doses required for a toxin, Staphylococcus aureus toxin B. First time ever. In carefully controlled experiments of 1 to 2 to 3 micron particles. Okay. We generate a 1 micron particle. It only takes 2.5 cells to infect and kill the guinea pig. It takes 14 cells to kill the monkey, LD50. It takes about 15 cells to infect man, these young soldiers. Very, very small number of organisms. At 6.5 micron particles, you can see that there's an increase in guinea pigs, monkeys, and humans. At 11.5 microns, again, the trend is upward. 18 and 22 microns, we start getting now very, very large numbers of organisms required for the infection. And this, of course, has a direct impact on the success, the number of infections you can cause on the target. At 22 microns, we didn't study humans. Now, not only does the number of organisms required to infect reduce the number of organisms, but it also has to do with the type of disease that you get. For example, this is in monkeys, the rhesus monkey. One micron particle causes 14 cells. The mean day of illness is only 4 days following exposure, and the physician rates that illness at about 4-5 plus, or the fever of 105 plus in that monkey, and you're going to get death. No question about it. At 6.5 microns, the disease in monkeys now requires 178 cells. The mean day of illness increases to 6 days. You still get a very severe disease, and you still get a very high temperature, and you still get death. But at 11.5 micron aerosol particles, you see there's a decided change. Requires 672 cells to tularemia to infect. Exposure time now increases to 9 days. The type of illness is only 3+, and with these degrees, levels of temperature, and you may or may not kill the monkey. At 18 microns, there's a decided increase in the mean day of illness. Incubation time is now 15 days. The severity of illness is 2+, and probably you will not kill the monkey. At 22 microns, well, you got problems if you're developing an agent. It's now 1+, 22-day incubation period, and the monkey is not killed. Let's look at the study with volunteers. There's no difference between 26 and 30 aerosol particles of tularemia. But you disseminate the material in a very small particle, and it takes between 4 and 5 days to infect with this level of infection, this level of challenge. And you get reasonable levels of fever. You get 86% infection from that concentration. And you, again, the physician establishes the infection of about 4+. But when you move up to 38,000 cells, gang, there's a significant reduction in incubation time. The disease becomes much more severe, and you have to start treating the material almost immediately after exposure. And at 52,000 cells, exposure time is reduced to 2 days, and high fever, you get 100% infection of these volunteers, and ladies and gentlemen, unless you start treatment almost immediately, you're going to lose some people. Now, having said that, we did not lose a single person in all these experiments we did with tularemia, Coxsella Burnetti, or Staphylococcus neurotoxin B. We had a meeting 2 years ago of the 50th anniversary of these young men, now middle-aged, and I described for them some of the procedures of how we made the material. We've carefully monitored these people over the last 50 years, and they have responded just like they've never been exposed. So the point I want to make is that in terms of biological warfare, you might get an entirely different infection, the infection occurring very rapidly, very nasty infection, and if you don't start treatment, if it's antibiotic sensitive, we're going to be behind the eight ball. This showing the same sort of relationship. Particle size causes an infection. Lesions in the lungs of monkeys in 24 hours, 8 microns, 48 hours, 11.5 micron aerosol causes infection, lesions in the monkey at 96 hours. Now, we're going to integrate in this rather confusing chart concentration. We're going to generate an aerosol of 1 micron particle size, and we're going to spray from a concentration of 5 × 10^8 spores of anthrax in exposed guinea pigs. So you should get a concentration of 10,000 spores in the respiratory tract. You split open respiratory tract and plate it, and you find that instead of getting 10,000 spores, you get 400. So you have a retention factor of only 2.5%. Again, looking at one micron particle and you spray from a concentration of 100 times 10 to the 8, you see that the calculated dose and the actual dose that you recover is increasing, and you get a retention factor of 43%. Now, that's a 1 micron particle, but suppose we generate now a 5 micron particle, and again spray from either 5 or 50 times 10 to the 8, our retention factor goes way, way down. So what you can do is compare 1 micron, 5 times 10 to the 8 versus 5 micron, 5 times 10 to the 8, and you see that you've had a substantial loss in retention factor. And, of course, as particle size increases, so does retention factor decrease. So we not only have a problem with particle size infectivity relationships, but we've got to have a concentration that's retained and that's maximized at about 1 micron and with higher concentrations of the material being used. So if we look at the retention factor in the lower respiratory tract, this is a curve. You find that particle size is where that blip occurs for the lower respiratory tract. The retention factor at upper respiratory tract is completely different. This is the cells per particle, and this is the viable cell per particle. So all these lines have to be integrated if you're doing product development studies to maximize and prepare a product that meets the requirements of weaponization. Now, I don't want to imply that big particles don't cause infection. They do. I went through and looked at the 800 aerosols that we had done with tularemia using either people or rhesus monkeys, and we find that there's a very sharp cutoff point regarding particle size and infection. At 18 to 20 microns that are in the aerosol, they're falling out almost immediately, falling that during the period of equilibration when big particles fall out. If you happen to be in that area, these big particles are going to fall in the eye, and you've got a typical pink eye conjunctivitis. 15, 18 microns will land in the pharynx, and you've got a pharyngeal infection. 7 to 12 microns are going in the trachea, and you've got a typical tracheal infection with tularemia. Now we're approaching what we want. 4 to 6 microns are going in the bronchi, bronchitis. And 1 to 3 micron particle is the one that defeats the respiratory tree in humans and causes a deep-seated infection in the lung sacs or alveoli, very hard to treat. It either kills you or makes you very, very difficult to treat. So my point is this. We want small particles within a 1 to 5 micron particle size. We want highly concentrated materials. And the worst thing we want are big particles because we don't want to cause pink eye. We want to kill people with this means of warfare, or at least make them very, very sick. Now, I start at the beginning of my talk, I told you that I wasn't going to discuss the morality of this, but I will say this, that from the standpoint of the U.S. program, we concentrated more on organisms that would produce an infection known as an incapacitating agent, did not kill. Although we did weaponize anthrax, we tried to weaponize plague, failed, because we couldn't maintain the virulence. But by and large, the policy of the United States to weaponize incapacitating agents. And we use these incapacitating agents together in a cocktail so that you could cause a incubation period from short to long periods of time. And with that happy note, I'm going to quit. The answer is no, sir.
Approximately 4 or 5 years ago in Western North Carolina, we experienced quite a bit of aerosol dispersals, I believe, overhead. There were like 6 wide-body airplanes coming over at a time with what I called chemtrails. Now, I wrote my congressman, he calls them contrails, but I said, no, this is not water vapor. The dispersal of the water vapor in the air is not occurring fast enough. And my research indicated that probably there was an agent such as methyl bromide, possibly a carrier such as soybean oil, and possibly an emulsifier such as liquid detergent. Anyway, I sent him these pictures, and he denied this. And this is near about 200 miles from Atlanta, and the flights were all in that direction. He said, well, these are all commercial flights. I said, not 6 abreast. You know, and it was the conjecture at the time of those of us that saw these things, and I saw pictures on the internet of wide-body jets with 2 extra canisters, or if you will, engine nacelle type looking things.
Right. What altitude were these pictures?
I would say I took them with just an ordinary camera from ground level at about 2,000 foot elevation where the city is.
Okay, we don't have to worry about those clouds.
20,000.
Those particles will never come down, and they will slowly become dissipated and be a non-factor.
But what was the purpose of those flights? I feel they were not ordinary controls.
I don't know, but there's a difference between, now we didn't get into the physics of the aerosol, that's another subject, about 2 hours in length.
Yes.
But when you disseminate a VW agent or any other particulate matter, as long as you see the material being disseminated, you can see the cloud.
Yes.
It's during that period called the period of equilibration, and big particles are falling out. And when you don't see the cloud, that's when you get your primary aerosol. That's the one that's going to infect you. You don't taste it. You don't see it. You don't smell it. It's composed of 1 to 5 micron particles, behaves as a gas. And you breathe it in because you have a vacuum pump. Now, we found that the closer to the ground that you, when you disseminate a BW agent, the better off you are. If you disseminate a BW agent more than about 500 to 750 feet above the terrain, that cloud may or may not ever come back down. It might go on up into the sky and become a non-factor. So, if you saw these trails, 20,000 feet, or even 5,000 feet, I wouldn't be concerned about a BW agent.
Okay, thank you.
Our government has spent a great deal of money developing very effective biological weapons in the name of defeating communism. But, you know, if you read the work of Dr. Sutton and many others who have studied the financing of communism and work recently done even to this very day, America has poured literally billions of dollars into the Soviet Union to create the best enemy money could buy. Now, one of the things that really bothers me today is the susceptibility of our nation. We heard in the last talk mentioned that there are effective treatments for neurological warfare agents, but the government refuses to make them available for the public, and you have to ask yourself why. A couple of $100 million, we might save, you know, a million lives, 10 million lives, 20 million lives. We could put money out for Tamiflu to benefit Donald Rumsfeld's company, but we can't have any money for developing a widespread use of antibiotics that could be used to protect the people in this country. I'm very concerned about the possibility of a biological attack or even a nuclear attack on this country. Why is it we don't have any effective means of protecting the American people today?
That's a good question. I couldn't agree with you, well, your concept of your question. I've always felt that when you have suppose you're given 2 million doses of tularemia and the infecting dose is 10 to 15 organisms, The disease that you get, unless you start treatment within about 10, 12 hours of the exposure, you're going to die. There's just no question about that. Now unless you intercede with antibiotics. Now the problem I have, and I'm talking to the choir now, most of you MDs will not give antibiotics to patients unless you have a diagnosis of disease. But you're right. If it's a viral disease, the antibiotic isn't going to help. But if it is a bacterial disease and you give a broad-spectrum antibiotic, I think you'll save a lot of people.
And, of course, it's very, very interesting. We had an anthrax attack in America immediately after 9-1-1. Dick Cheney and the White House staff went on Cipro the evening of 9-11. I wonder why they didn't tell the rest of the American people. They were going on to Cipro to protect themselves from a anthrax attack. It's interesting that all of those letters went to Democrats.
Yep.
Thank you.
Dr. Hausman pointed out a very good thing, and that is the plastic, the rolls of plastic but duct tape was just poo-pooed by the media. And yet, from my point of view, I have a room in my house that I'm going to duct tape if Washington is hit or New York and what have you, just in case Frederick, Maryland is hit. But if Washington is hit, I tell all you folks to move to Montana, the mountains of Montana, because the Soviet Union learned, and we relearned this, that when you're in the mountainous country, the sheer forces of wind tears up an aerosol very quickly and it becomes a non-factor. Yes.
I just was going to mention that unless we have more than 88 cubic feet per person, that duct tape and plastic will kill us in about 3 hours because the carbon dioxide will build to that point. But I'm sure you're well aware of that.
Yeah.
But our company, Utah Shelter Systems, builds and designs MBC shelters, and we have incorporated into these shelters a filtration system that has been built in Switzerland, a fine. It used to be called the Lua. You're probably aware of it. It's now made by Andair. Once we get into these shelters, if there is an attack, of course, we're perfectly safe at that point. But when we come out of that filtered environment, my question is, how long would these agents persist in our homes, in our ducting systems, in our carpets, in our clothing, because we don't get the sunlight there? How long would we feel that we would have to stay out of our homes?
Very short period of time. The aerosol is constantly moving. The primary aerosol is one that's going to infect you. It's going and going. I just hate to see people on these programs, people running around in all these suits with gas masks and their own air supply and what have you. It's very few occasions where you need that sort of a protection. When a munition is not going off properly and you got a powder there, that's where you need all the protection. But from the standpoint of the primary aerosol, you will not find many instances where you need all that protection. It's gone. And if you haven't protected yourself against that primary aerosol, it's Katie bar the door. It's too late.
So you don't think these aerosols will actually penetrate into our homes?
Yes, they will. No question about it. But our houses are very loose. And the fact that they bleed a lot of air in and out means that they're going to bleed that primary aerosol out, too.
Okay.
It won't stay around very long. Okay. I'd say no more than a day.
Right. Thank you very
okay.
much.
By the way, when the details of this Fairlock accident occurred, the people downwind of that column of anthrax are... They're very poor people. They have very tight homes, and they button their house up to protect themselves from the cold. And in many instances, the aerosol was not able to protect, was not able to go into the house. Now we don't have that. We have exactly the opposite. We have air conditioning houses, and we pull air in. We have well insulated houses, but they're not airtight. Yes.
A simple question. Are either exposing a flaw in your statistics? I can only get 25 1-micron size particles in a 5-micron size particle. You got 53.
That's right. I'll have to check with the mathematician who did that and rechecked it many times.
2.5 versus
right.
2.5 cubed, that's 20 pi.
No, it's pi r squared for area. Oh, you're doing it fine. No, I got it. You're right.
Okay. You've been a very good audience. Thank you.